Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
Come on down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
So, Ken, I remember you talking about last year's Champions League final and about Bayern Munich's insistence on playing a high line against PSG, even though it seemed like it could be an extraordinarily bad idea against Neymar and Mbappe. And Hansi Flick just said, well, you know, I've got a good team too, so let's just roll with it. It's weird that it's the same game, one shortened season apart, that provides us with such a counterpoint to Pep on Saturday night. Because, and I know it nearly seems unfair to start today's show by pointing out that Pep really screwed this one up, but bloody hell, Pep, you kind of screwed this one up. And not just screwed it up, but in such a specifically Pep-ish way as to practically beg people like me to come to the conclusion that it was the decisive factor in the game. Chelsea are the champions of Europe. The Manchester City project is still without its moment of completion, and it's your second captain's football show. Hello, Ken, how are you?
I was about to say, Owen, how are you? But
Owen is not here.
Kieran, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Ken. I'm doing good. But I suppose the argument here is that Chelsea have now beaten City 3 times in 6 weeks, so Pep had to try something. But it really fell flat in its face.
Well, is there? The phrase "if it ain't broke, don't fix it."
Mm.
Where does the phrase originate? I believe. I don't think you're going to get. I don't think you're going to guess this. I believe it was Bert Lentz, an official in the Jimmy Carter administration, to the newsletter of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1977.
You know, funnily enough, I wasn't going to get that.
He's believed to have popularized the phrase by saying stuff like, you know, in the course of an interview where he expressed opinions like, this is the problem with government. You know, we try to fix things that aren't broken and break things that aren't broken.
Break things that are fixed?
Break things
or
that
at
are,
least
yeah,
not
break
broken.
Things that are fixed. Fix things that aren't broken and also we break those things. But you know, it is believed to have, he is believed not to have necessarily come up with the phrase himself, but simply to have channeled the folk wisdom of the rural southern United States into this august journal, and thenceforth into the wider imagination. From the oral to the printed tradition, and thence across the Atlantic and into this conversation. The thing is, I don't know. I mean, this phrase jumped from the farms of the Deep South into this U.S. Chamber of Commerce newsletter into the wider, across the Atlantic ultimately. But I don't know if it made it all the way to Catalonia because, you know, it's just a different culture really, isn't it? You know, when you think about those farms in the American South compared to the city of Barcelona. We're talking about two different cultures. We're talking in Barcelona about a people obsessed with ideas, with theories, that they started building a cathedral sometime like about 100 years ago, and they still haven't finished it yet. They're still tinkering. They're still tinkering with that thing. And the whole spirit of if it ain't broke, don't fix it has never really excited the people of Barcelona and of Catalonia, and nor one of their most famous sons, Pep. I just don't know if they have that phrase. If they do, it's not one that he chooses to live by. And although I'm not so sure that he was necessarily to blame for it, I just feel as though we're going to get into all this. Let's do our housekeeping and let's get into this.
Yeah, we have Miguel Delaney and Jonathan Wilson coming up in just a few minutes. But, you know, this game should, I suppose, mark the end of the football season. But not this summer, of course, because the Euros are coming.
Talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened, but talk us through it.
Robbie Brady against Hugo Lloris. Ireland leading Lyon. What a start. What a perfect start.
Crosses back to the edge of the penalty.
Into the penalty.
Get it!
The only thing that they have got is the big boy up front, Sigurdsson, who really, Sigurdsson.
You're talking about finals.
Final.
You know what I'm talking about.
I'm Declan Rice.
I'm Jack Grealish.
Oh, oh my word. Oh.
They're all pampered. They're all just headphones.
Oh, just saying. Sigurdsson.
Yes, the best, most fun football to cover on the podcast, International Football Tournaments. It's coming right up for the entire month of June and into July. You'll get it all right here. So there couldn't possibly be a better time to sign up for the Second Captain's World Service. It's just €5 a month plus VAT. No cancellation fee, no contract. Why not give it a try from tomorrow? And we'd be delighted to have you. Go to secondcaptains.com/join and you'll be signed up in no time. And in the meantime, before the Euros begin next week, we have another great week coming up, including Jack McCaffrey on Nick Hornby's Fever Pitch in another edition of the I'll Tell You Who Wrote It Second Captain's Book Club. Here, Jack explains the complex root causes of his long-standing love affair with the Arsenal.
There was one moment when I asked my mum, she was heading into town, to buy me a pair of slippers if she could, and she picked up a pair of Arsenal slippers. They were on sale. And genuinely was like, I can't, like they were pretty woeful anyway, but I was like, I can't be wearing these if I'm not supporting Arsenal. So
sorry, what age are we talking about? 17 or
probably closer to 21, but anyway. No, I was still in school at the time, in fairness. And yeah,
sorry, then, primary school or secondary?
We're talking
secondary school.
I'm 15 year old.
And okay,
so we're talking about 2008 here, like not 2009, like not successful Arsenal at all.
No, I haven't met that team.
Yeah, that's coming up very shortly this week. We also have a very exciting players' chair upcoming. Mick McCarthy rule still applies, of course. We have two Ireland friendlies and the first two wins of Bossman Steele's reign coming right up in the next 10 days or so, too. So lots to look forward to. But Ken, if you would now like to report on some sport, please, that would be tremendous.
I've just actually been checking the date of the beginning of the Sagrada Familia. The Basilica de la Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. 1882, they started building that thing, and it's still not finished. It's still not finished.
They're thinking for the 150th.
The Sagrada Familia is a process, you know. The Sagrada Familia is about the journey, not necessarily the destination.
I mean, I like that as a kind of life, you know, motto, as a life slogan, but not with architecture. You know, I kind of feel like, let's just make our mind up about this piece of architecture. You know, let's build it, let's everyone look at it, and then let's decide whether we like it or not. But this idea that we have to, you know, sort of, that we have to take such a, you know, an active part in watching it go up. Yeah. You know, I mean, is there any chance that I will see a completed Sagrada Familia? I mean,
to be honest, if you wouldn't be able to tell, like, it looks finished. Like if you were there, and they may have scaffolding up around it, or you know, there may be people going around with hard hats. But it does look as though, yeah, it's done. I don't really, to be honest, I don't even really know what they're still tinkering with, but apparently they are. So,
well, like, who gets to say it's done?
I don't know. I don't even know. Like, who?
That's the process I'd like to hear about.
They've had to hand down the project a few times, but you know, like, just reading about Pep Guardiola's overthinking. I mean, I thought Sam Lee's article in The Athletic, you know, he probably overthought Bayern's 3-2 aggregate win over Benfica in the 2015-16 quarterfinals also. A match in which he believed the Portuguese side to be so good that he hunched over his laptop for so long analysing 10 of their previous matches, he put his back out.
Yeah, I love that detail as well.
this is penance. Like, you know, this is long beyond the point at which, you know, there's any actual real value being, you know, what was his big idea a bit later? Like, wasn't it dropping Thomas Müller for a game against Atletico Madrid? Dropping Thomas Müller often doesn't really work out for the manager. It does it. But, you know, it's like, it's into the realms of, like, it's like sort of ritual. This is some offering to the gods or whatever it is that Pep Guardiola believes in. Like,
I don't even understand the narrative anymore, though. I mean, because we got it. Like, we were talking about this 2 or 3 years ago, that Pep overthinks these games. Mm. So, you know, I don't know what lessons we're supposed to take into our own lives from this sort of torture, this torture of Pep Guardiola and his massive football brain.
Just that he's still doing it, and he doesn't apparently subject the process itself to any meta-analysis of, you know, hang on a second, should I still do it this way, or, you know, is there anything I can?
He's analyzing everything except the over-analysis,
the process.
So
against this, you've got Thomas Tuchel. I mean, we'll talk about Pep later with Wilson and Miguel, but in contrast to this, the smiling, the dazzling figure of Thomas Tuchel, the new European champion, the man who came back from defeat in last season's final to win at the second time of asking with a different team, and his transformation of a team which, to be honest, looked like an absolute dead dog floating down the river as recently as July. I mean, what did Harry Redknapp think of it when he went on TalkSport shortly after Frank Lampard was shown the door? What did Harry Redknapp say?
I've not yet seen a manager that can turn very average players into great players. I'm still looking to see somebody who can do that.
Well, there you go. The dog suddenly comes back to life, swims to the bank, jumps out, you know, shakes awful canal water over everybody. And bounds away. It's a beautiful thing to see. That's what Thomas Tuchel has done. He's brought this dead dog back to life. You know, and
you know, funny, it happened pretty fast as well.
Overnight. It was 3 days, about the same as Jesus. Mm. You know, coming back to life at around the same type of speed as our Lord.
Mm. Which is pretty fast. I mean, you know, when you're talking about reanimation of sentient life, that doesn't happen all that often.
I haven't seen it done any faster. So how has he done it? I mean, I suppose what he's done is he's come in and his attitude has been, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So the big difference between Thomas Tuchel and Lampard, there are many differences, so it's a mistake to say the big difference, but one big difference, I think, has been just the whole attitude that Tuchel was projecting from the moment he arrived. So if you remember the first big thing when Tuchel arrived, I mean, besides all these very overwrought articles about, oh, Lampard should have been given time and he was used by Chelsea and it was all a plot and they brought in these Germans, you know, and as we know, Frank Lampard didn't have anything to do with those Germans, and we know, thanks to his uncle.
Did he bring the players in? Did he bring the Germans in?
No, he certainly did not. He certainly did not. Let's not forget that. Let's not forget that was
Kai
Havertz.
We will not forget that. Yeah.
Kai Havertz, the Champions League winning goal. But, you know, aside from the fact that this German usurper now sat there in Frank's Iron Throne, he was only there in an 18-month contract. And people, I think, were saying at the time, well, you know, you've only got 18 months there, mate. You know, and you're sitting there, you seem pretty, you know, it's a big grin for a guy who's only got an 18-month contract. You know, what do you think about that? Like, you know, you're obviously just as disposable as the last, the sadly betrayed Lampard. And his whole attitude to that right from the beginning was, yeah, you know, I did actually think it was a bit weird when they offered me 18 months. But then I thought, you know what? like, it doesn't actually matter. Like, it doesn't matter what my contract says. If they're not happy with me, they're going to sack me. And that's fine. Like, I don't care. You know, they'll sack me if they're not happy. It doesn't matter if the contract says 5 years, 4.5 years, 18 months. They'll sack me. So I don't need to worry about that. All I need to worry about is, what is the bits that I can actually affect. You know, I can't really control that. It's the same with every top team. This is a top team. I want to be here. So I'm just going to concentrate on the team, which is my responsibility. And he had this sort of attitude right from the off. Like, he wasn't whereas Lampard had clearly become consumed by worry over what was going on, right? Lampard had got into this, like, absolute doom spiral of paranoia, I think. Because the job meant so much to him. Because it's like, I don't know if you saw John Terry's interview recently. John Terry did an interview in, like, the Sunday Times, I think.
Yes.
Sunday Times or the Times. I was surprised by it, because even for John Terry, I just thought this was a bit much, where he goes, you know, I've got a plan, and that plan is to be the manager of Chelsea Football Club, or that my plan involves managing Chelsea Football Club. And I just sort of thought, like, it's too specific. Your dream is too specific. Like, you played for Chelsea, but that doesn't mean that you're going to become a great manager of Chelsea. You should be just dreaming of being a successful manager the same way that you were a successful player. It doesn't have to be Chelsea that you manage. That's just too, it's asking too much. You know what I mean? I'm not like, okay, it's not unfeasible that Terry could become the Chelsea manager someday, because he is obviously the huge figure in the history of Chelsea and the fans like him, blah, 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 blah. But like, the idea that should be a condition of his dream, as opposed to just, I want to be successful as a manager, just seems like, why narrow down your possibilities so much? You know what I mean? Like, I can only be happy with this dream. It's, my dream is incredibly specific. I manage Chelsea.
Shit, I'm manager of Barcelona. What a nightmare.
Yeah, you know, or like, it just struck me as kind of, and I suppose the link with Lampard here is that I feel as though managing Chelsea to these guys is like, oh, this is the only job. This is the job. You know what I mean? For Lampard. Whereas for Tuchel, it's like a job. Oh, great. I've got a job working for one of the teams who could win the Champions League. There's not many of them around Europe, but this is one of them, right? And that's great. Like, you can't actually ask for more as a manager unless you're kind of like John Terry or, you know, Frank Lampard. I can't see he was on the record necessarily saying this, but like, he's like, oh, Chelsea's the only thing that counts. And I honestly think this probably had something to do with the way that it just sank on Lampard. Like, he just became so kind of broody. In fairness, he always has been a bit thin-skinned, and even at Derby he was like this. It's not like he grew up dreaming of managing Derby, but like, it was just too personal for him, you know, this whole thing. And they needed to
The one thing you could say about Tuchel and Chelsea is that personal is absolute, that never came into it, you know. It was a business proposition from the second he said, if they're not happy after 18 months, they will sack me. I will get sacked at some stage. That's just the reality of this job. So let's just crack on.
A business proposition, but also, you know, he's prepared to like get, like, I mean, you could see the celebrations with him and the players. You know, this is great. But like, he recognizes this is a moment. Like, the beautiful thing about this is that it's only this moment, and then it's gone. You know what I mean? And let's not worry. Let's just move on. I kind of feel as though with him, that's a big thing that he's trying to do at all times. It's like, you know, I want to be living in the moment. Because it's not like he doesn't care. Like, he has a detachment towards the idea of, like, he accepts that it's inevitable that he will be sacked by Chelsea. Of course. I mean, that's how this story ends, of course. But like, we know that, so why worry about it? You know, like I'm not going to sit here brooding about, oh, you know, what if they, you know, do they really believe in me, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I'm here today. Let's do a good training session. Oh, this player has let me down. I'm going to absolutely destroy this guy in front of the squad. I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, and then tomorrow I'll act as though that never happened. You know, he sort of is a bit like this, as opposed to sort of, you know, brooding sort of, oh, I'm not sure about this player, I think they might be talking behind my back, oh, I'm gonna kick this guy out of the squad, you know, this guy is training with the youths, you know, this type of just ultimately destructive stuff.
Posturing,
I
suppose, or,
but this is all kind of the long distance tickle stuff. What's the other thing he does? The courage to change the things I can. So what does he do? He basically controls everything on the field to an extraordinary degree. Like, the difference between Chelsea's games after Tuchel and before Tuchel and after Tuchel is control. Right, so Lampard, 29 matches under Lampard this season, 88 goals in those matches, but for and against. Since Tuchel took over, it's 55 in 30 matches. So, you know, that's a huge drop off. They go from conceding 28 goals in 29 matches. And remember, they conceded something like 75 goals in 50 odd matches last season. So they'd already improved a little bit with like bringing in Thiago Silva, but it's still like a goal a game, pretty much a goal a game, to conceding 16 and 30. And if you remember, five of those goals were in that mad game against West Brom when CR7 demolished them, right? Mm. And Tuchel actually destroyed a few of his players afterwards as well. You know, but like if you take out this one aberration of a game, I know everyone's average improves when you take out their worst result, but if you do take that, it's 11 goals in 29. So the same, you know, 29 matches for Lampard, 29 for Tuchel, 11 conceded. And that's the reason why Chelsea are now the champions. I think it's the best defensive record of any team. Like, four goals is, no one's let in fewer than four goals to win the Champions League. They were behind for a total of 5 minutes. Obviously, Lampard was in charge for some of that as well. But this control that he's brought, I remember he did it immediately. Like, he came in, he said, okay, the first thing we'll do is we'll change formation. You know, they hadn't used that formation. They had played three at the back in one game under Lampard, which was the one against Man United. Remember, they had this non-event of a game. I think it was nil all. And I think Lampard played three at the back in that, and otherwise it was always a back four. And Tuchel played a back four, I think, in his first match, and then from that moment on, it was 3-4-3. He took that. That was as quickly as it took him to find the formula that has ended up delivering the Champions League. But what he said after the game, I mean, he said loads of things after the game. But one of them was, we wanted to be the stone in their shoe. We wanted to be the stone in their clockwork. This was Chelsea's approach to City. Because it was just after, I think, there had been this kind of embrace between Tuchel and Guardiola, which is always a bit awkward. It's like, yes, you know, we've got so much mutual respect. However, this must be absolute agony, you know, to still have to do this, for Guardiola anyway. And probably Tuchel, to be honest, didn't really want to see him at that point either. But we want to be the stone in their clockwork. But the thing is, they actually do have quite a lot of clockwork of their own. Like, it is easier to be the stone than the clockwork, you could say. Like, it's easier to sort of disrupt this carefully calibrated mechanism of Man City's. But actually, the interesting thing about Chelsea is the little automatic patterns that they also have. And this is something I noticed watching the first game. Well, actually, I noticed it not during the game itself, but when trying to go back and just look at the moves leading up to the Chelsea goal. So, you know, I was kind of rewinding through this like long TV, you know, I'm just trying to find, you know, the goal's around 42, or it's, you know, fast forwarding. And then I'm like, oh, this is it. This looks like it, you know, and it's a pass.
So you kept thinking you had seen it before, that you were about to see the goal, but
no, I knew it was around the sort of 40 minute mark. So I was kind of going to around then, because I started it, you know, from the, and I had to fast forward. So I was fast forwarding it, you know, 30 times speed. You don't see a lot. And then I was kind of slowing it down, and I was like, oh, okay, this looks like it. And it was basically a pass out to Chilwell and a first time ball on to Mount. And I thought, this is it. And then it played out and it wasn't it. And I thought, hang on a second, that really looked like it. And because it was the same thing with the strikers running ahead. The two Chelsea strikers are making this, when I say the two strikers, I mean Werner and Havertz, are making this diagonal run. And one of them, Diaz, is following one, the inside one, and then the outside one is being followed by Zinchenko. So it's the same move, right? It's literally the move that they scored the goal from. So I thought, hang on, that's not this. What actually happened here? This is sort of interesting. Because, you know, the way you're watching a game and, like, you don't really notice. Well, I don't really notice these things. It's very difficult, I think, to spot patterns or to remember stuff that happened. You know, I mean, it's hard to remember who kicked the ball three passes ago. You know what I mean? Like, and this is one of the billion reasons why I am not a professional football player. Inability to spot these patterns, you know what I mean? Some people, I think, can do it, and other people need to rewatch several times and go, oh, right, okay.
But a clumsy fast forward,
and, you know, and it also needs to be just close enough, separated by only 2 minutes, that like you would actually notice it. So, I mean, okay, scouting software will actually do this for you. Like, you know, if you just looked at, you know, show me Mason Mount's touches in the game, you would pretty quickly see this. Or if you see Ben Chilwell, you see, oh, Ben Chilwell just keeps doing the same thing. He just keeps being there on the sideline and kind of playing a little wall pass to Mount, right? But so what happens is, for that 40-minute move, basically Mount, Stones is close enough to Mount that he can't pass it to one of the forwards. So he gets it. I think he gives it to Chilwell, gets it back, and then plays it crossfield to Reece James. So watching what happens then is also interesting, because Chelsea are like, okay, we've got possession of the ball in the City half, but they're not going to kind of go crazy with this ball and try and run forward in a kamikaze attack and try and, you know, play their way through City. They're just playing the ball around a little bit in midfield, and City are sort of chasing them. You know, City were putting a lot of energy into the game. Bernardo Silva, I think, is the one who eventually comes in with a tackle, knocks it out for a throw. And then Chelsea have this throw, and it's like, what are we going to do with it? Throw it back. And they kind of go back, and Azpilicueta gives it to Christensen, I guess. He had actually just come on for Thiago Silva a couple of minutes before. Back to Mendy. And the City players are now all pushing up. So this is the ingenious thing about it. This is actually a trap. So Mendy then plays it back to the defenders, and they pass it a bit more. And the City players are now well up. Like, there's five of them are now entering, like, the Chelsea third, right? Because you could see Guardiola on the touchline, like, get up. Like, he's making this gesture the whole time, like, squeeze up, like, to John Stones and his boys. And then, so Chelsea are kind of like, they look like, oh, we don't really know what to do with this. You know, we're kind of unsure. City aren't giving us much space. We don't want to give it away. Let's pass it around at the back a bit more rather than go into that dangerous area where they're going to take the ball off us and expose us. And City are pushing up fearlessly. They're like, we are City. You know, we put them under pressure. The ball goes back to Mendy. And then Chelsea do the same thing again. So Mendy chips it out to Chilwell over Mahrez. Chilwell knocks it first time to Mason Mount. This time, John Stones is not close to Mason Mount, and he can turn inside. He keeps trying to do this, gets the ball from Chilwell, turns inside, and now he knows that Stones is the closest. Walker has already gone to run at Chilwell. He's out of the game because of the little first time knock on. Stones is the closest player to Mount, which leaves who? Diaz and Zinchenko. And looking, as Mount looks up, he can see Werner running across. Diaz is following him. And then on the far side, Havertz running into the middle with Zinchenko trailing far behind him. And Havertz pointing, you know where, I don't need to point, I'm just pointing here. You know where this is going. And Mount obviously plays a perfect pass. Ederson, as everybody knows he's going to do, comes charging out. But the pass is perfectly weighted so that Havertz is able to get there first. And that's the goal. So it was brilliant. But the thing is, go back through the half. This actually happens. That was the fifth time they'd done it. So I went back through looking, okay, are there any more examples of this? Yeah, there's five more examples. Well, so four more examples, apart from the 48th minute, I think it was 17th minute, 38th minute, 32nd minute, where they try the same thing. And it's
a beautiful feeling that must be for it to come off and for it to win the Champions League for you.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. But it's like, it's like, how do you break down Man City? Like, that's a problem. You know, how do you actually do this against a team that keeps the ball so well? You know, we know that Diaz had a great season. The goalkeeper leaves so little space behind the back, behind the back four. You know, he's always out onto balls. How do you do that? I mean, one obvious way is by a set piece. Maybe someone can head in a corner. You know, that's one thing that you might be able to do. But if you're in open play, if we have the ball, what can we do? And this is like a move. It's a simple move. It's like a set piece. You know, it's like a set piece that you can play in open play. When they've got the ball. And that's why I thought that the goal move itself was particularly interesting, because of the way that Chelsea set Man City up for it by dragging them into their, well, City want to push up, like, so let's let them do that. We'll move the ball back and play. Our goalkeeper will swap pass with the defenders until they're all up at halfway, and that's when we'll try run our little move again. And yeah, so this I thought was an interesting thing about the game. In the second half, they did basically any of this, because the second half, the other thing about it, it's like what your man says. Remember, Raphael Honigstein had the quote from Kravitz, this Klopp's assistant, Peter Kravitz: football is like chess with dice, right? So you can do clever things, like, but it's not really all about that. It also is about the bounce of the ball and whether the referee gives a penalty to the team for, like, a random, you know, there's loads of random chance.
Sends off Tony Rudiger for
breaking Kevin De Bruyne's face, you know. And, like, the thing about it is, right, I mean, it was obviously a deliberate foul, and it's a serious injury. Like, it's a boxer injury. It's a Billy Joe Saunders injury that Kevin De Bruyne has now. Although apparently, so Christoph Terreur was saying, the Belgian journalist was saying that he's expected to be fine for the Euros. And I thought, oh, well, I mean, fair play. You know, with a broken orbital bone and a broken nose. Like,
I have to say, if it was a rugby player that got that injury, I mean, Rudiger is getting sent off so fast.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, if it happened in rugby, it's like, well, forget about broken bones. Is Kevin De Bruyne's brain going to be okay? You know, because he was heavily concussed. But judging by how he had to get down the stairs to the dressing room, like holding the wall, that is a serious injury.
Yeah, and you know, he was sitting there, and there was that shot of him sort of seeming to try to concentrate on what was happening on the field. You know, his eyes are kind of like darting from one side to the other. And then he was being helped away in a few minutes.
Yeah.
It was terrible, but like it was awful. Its consequences were terrible, and by the consequences, you know, Rudiger should be sent off. But in practice, it's the kind of thing that actually happens a lot in football. Like in rugby, they're looking out for that because shoulder to the head is an accepted, you know, rugby dark art, let's say. So it's like specifically you can't do that. Whereas in football, you know, you're obviously not meant to do it. You do see it done. Like I saw a really horrible example of it in the World Cup final in 2014 against the German player Kramer, wasn't it? Who one of the Argentinians centre backs, Ezequiel Garay, maybe. I can't remember which one of them it was.
I'm pretty impressed.
I was pretty
impressed with the Kramer bit. So, well, yeah, but he was. He was concussed. I do remember that in the World Cup final. Yeah,
leveled. It was again like that. Like it's a move that you can really disguise because the movement is so short. It's like all you're doing is sort of almost bracing yourself and putting the shoulder into the face, and you can do it. The only way that the referee should notice it really is the way that the victim of it tends to turn 90 degrees in the air before falling on their back. Like, you know, I mean, it was so, but what I mean is, should he have been sent off? If he had been, I mean, you could have pointed to De Bruyne's face and said, look, you've broken the guy's face. And at the same time, like Fernandinho did the same thing in the game, you know, without the consequence is what I mean. Like when Fernandinho came on, and he's a player who will do that a lot. Because really what Rudiger's doing is blocking the run that he realizes, oh no, he's like, this guy's going past me. No, he's not. So I'll take a yellow card here because this is an obvious block. I don't think he means to do it. But then again, you can't say, like, you know, it's similar to the Ramos.
He knows what height he is. Yeah, he knows what height he is. He knows what height Kevin De Bruyne is. I mean, when Fernandinho does it, it usually means someone gets body checked in the chest.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, there has to be an awareness by a player of the height differential and the percentage chance of where the impact happens. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just controlling yourself in the tackle. It's the exact same argument.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that he basically did something which was dangerous to his opponent without, you know, he didn't. There wasn't really due care there. Maybe he should have been sent off. I mean, I do feel it's a bit Ramos-like, and it had the similar consequence of the best player of the opposing team going off in tears. You know what I mean? And you know, a big moment in the game. And you know, not one I don't think that was in Thomas Tuchel's script. But like, I suppose he'll take it. You know, that's what you pick. Pick Rudiger for, you know, just I want to make sure our team has that edge. You know, Lampard used to complain sometimes about his team being nice guys, but he also left Rudiger out, so you know, that didn't make much sense. But look, it's not all about that. I just want to mention one other thing before we go to Miguel and Jonathan, which is we got an email, a really long email. I'm afraid I brutally insulted Luke Crowley Holland, member of the Chelsea Supporters Trust and Kerry Blue, by not being super excited about the Champions League final on Friday before it happened. Now, to be honest, I was not. I was not super excited about it the day before, although I fully intended to watch it. And, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, you know, I've got the rest of my life to get on with now, so I'm not actually going to think about Chelsea Man City all day today on Friday. But, you know, I look forward to the game, and we're going to talk about that in more depth on Monday. So I hope that we've done that for you, Luke. I just want to mention, though, the email, because the email is like book length, so I can't read it out. I'm just going to give you a little pressy. He starts off by saying, you know, I respect your work. In your News Talk days, you were often grossly anti-Chelsea and particularly pro-Manchester United, like the rest of the media, which is saturated with pro-United content. And he speculates that we were presumably pumping out all that Man United propaganda because we had to cater to the, you know, half the audience being United fans as we were. And also that we had to produce too much content. He made allowances for the fact that it was just, you know, just having to produce all this rubbish, you know. But unfortunately, we'd stepped back into some lazy old habits. After the United FC Fan Club podcast, this would have been Thursday's post Europa League, United FC Fan Club podcast, when we, I think, heavily criticized.
I called for the manager to be sacked the day before, so I don't know, I don't know what that means.
I eagerly awaited your preview of the biggest game in club football, only to get a dismissive few minutes from Ken. Disregarded the history of Chelsea and Man City and suggested he was bored by the prospect of the meeting on Saturday. As such, I'm left wondering where the hypocrisy ends and the ignorance begins. So it goes on to what follows is a tour de force of geopolitical analysis, starting with the proposition you can't morally equate the ownership of Chelsea and Man City unless we want to deploy a heavy dose of xenophobia. Perhaps left over from the decades of Red Scare propaganda. We can all agree there is no moral, social, or political superiority to the ownership of the vast majority of EPL clubs and Chelsea. Obviously, City are in a different category. He is a Kerry blue. That's a royal blue, not a sky blue. Mm. So this is because, and again, this is heavily condensed, the true blight on the planet is obviously English-originated and American-propagated capitalist plutocracy. Russian oligarchs like Roman Abramovich are simply the mutant offspring of neoliberal shock doctrine applied to Russia in the 90s. You know, which is true. That's true. American plutocracy is the true Satan. Chelsea do have history. If only they'd agreed to enter the European Cup in the 1950s instead of 30 days of the invitation, maybe more people would respect that. Abramovich was a logical progression in terms of Premier League club ownership. The rich have always put money into football, you know, looking for popular acclaim. Look at Manchester and Liverpool, two cities built on slavery and the proceeds of slavery. You know, where did all the cotton for those mills come from? You know what I'm saying? People don't talk about this enough. Yes, the Glazers have been bad owners, but the fact remains, Man United have spent hundreds of millions and they've won nothing. They're brainless and incompetent. You know, if spending alone could, if money and spending alone brought success, then Man United wouldn't be such a basket case of a club. You cannot win just by spending. They wouldn't be so useless. They're the proof that you need skill as well. So, in conclusion, if you don't mind, could you please play out the show with either Blue Day or Blue is the Colour, two of the great football songs. Yours sincerely, Luke Crowley Holland. So, exhale. I think that was that written before the game? 30th? No.
No, that was 30th is yesterday.
The 30th of May, 2021, at 23:51. So Chelsea have barely been European champions for 24 hours. And this, well, I hope you're feeling better after getting all that off your chest, Luke. But yeah, that's...
And congratulations, Luke. I mean, your team are champions of Europe.
Okay, congratulations. So it turns out that Lampard actually does, he genuinely does feel that sorry for himself. To send him out into the Premier League, expecting him to get results with this squad, with this group of players. Like, the fact is, he looks at that squad, and in his head, all he can hear is, this is his exquisite self-pity. Timo Werner. Like, Timo Werner. Imagine.
That's one for the players. Players have to take the responsibility because the message was clear.
Did he bring the players in? Did he bring the Germans in?
And then Jody Morrison's like, boss, you know, what are we going to do? And he's like, he breaks out of this review. But like, can you believe that what they're doing to Lampard?
Well, what a triumph for Thomas Tuchel and his Chelsea players. You called it, Miguel, I have to say, after a couple of weeks. It only took you like 3 or 4 matches worth of Thomas Tuchel to say, I think this Chelsea team could win the Champions League. What an impact this guy has had. How has he turned this Chelsea team around?
Being a much better manager than Frank Lampard.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It took like 7 words to get the knife in. 7 words.
I mean, if we're talking about turning it around, that is the context. Lampard was underperforming. I mean, because even when I made that prediction, okay, it looks all right now. I made many bad predictions this season. Chelsea, they are a super club. They're always going to be thereabouts. This summer, they made sure, I think, bar possibly a striker, which they're already trying to rectify with their signings this summer, they have probably the best squad in Europe. I think that was apparent early on. That doesn't necessarily mean the best team, but they just had to be banged into shape a bit, which Tuchel did. And while that didn't necessarily mean they were good enough for a league challenge this season, I mean, they were too far behind when he took over, I just always thought they were well set up in Europe, especially with the way Tuchel coaches. And from that perspective, I mean, so much of the build-up in this game, it felt like Chelsea were almost the other team to a degree, and it was built up as if it was going to be Guardiola's crowning moment and a decade after 2011, all of that. Whereas what Tuchel has done has shown that he's probably Guardiola's peer in that regard. As good a manager, I mean, probably a little bit early to say, but certainly many of the ingredients are there. And certainly in this specific match, he outthought him.
Yeah, and you know, what is really impressive about the transformation, because it was so rapid and so complete, you know, with this Chelsea team. Like, you know, the number of goals in their matches like fell off a cliff, you know, and but luckily for them, the number of goals they were letting in fell off a cliff by much more than the number of goals they were scoring. Like, so it just turned into these sort of much more controlled, sensible type of matches. But he did this with no preseason, no time to train. You know, they've played 30 matches since he came in at the end of January. Like, there hasn't really been any time to sort of to rewire the programming of the squad, yet he's managed to do it. How do you think, what's his secret there, Jonathan?
I mean, I don't know what his secret is, but I think something that's really interesting and will be interesting in terms of what he does next season is this use of a 3-4-2-1, which I don't think we've really talked about that much. That is, you know, it's not a formation he's ever used before, or certainly not used regularly before. And it's as though he sort of came in and did a very quick calculation of, all right, what players do I have? What's the simplest way of playing? And I was sort of looking at this in terms of what City have done better this season. And I think where City have been better this season, in terms of preventing the opposition countering against them, which it was a huge problem last season. Look at how many games they lost last season to goals conceded on the break. And what they do is they consistently try and keep 5 men behind the ball. And if you're playing with that 3-4-2-1, you sort of have that automatically. You have the back three, and then you have the two holding midfielders, so Kante and Jorginho on Saturday. And so it's a very sort of solid base to start with. And then you can fiddle around in front of that. Now, my suspicion is Tuchel will move to a back four next season. I don't know, maybe he won't. Maybe he'll just think, well, this worked, we'll stick with this. Because I think the problem with a 3-4-2-1 is...
You don't score enough.
It is slightly blockish, it is slightly predictable, that you don't have enough angles of attack. And maybe that is rectified with a better centre-forward. But I think there's a reason why it's not sort of a particularly popular formation. I think it is slightly simplistic. But for a quick fix when you come in, and maybe for something like, you know, for international football where you don't have a lot of time with the squad, I think it is a way of getting a solid base. And then you have some flexibility because you have the wing backs who, you know, you can adjust their position. You've got the two midfield creators who, yeah, they can pull wide, they can drop deeper, then go further forward. You can even fiddle with the base of the midfield. You can play a slightly more attacking player in there if you want to. So there are some options there. But I think that's how he's been able to do it so quickly, is he's taken a pretty simple formation and a simple way of playing. I mean, yeah, simple is relative there. And he's seen that that squad, which still has somewhere in its DNA what Antonio Conte was doing with it, that that was right for that. And even though he'd never played it before, he imposed that. And it's from a defensive point of view, it's worked spectacularly well. I mean, you have five clean sheets in 7 Champions League knockout games.
Yeah, but you know, I, again, is there something? Is there mean-spiritedness at the core of what you're saying?
No, not at all.
Because you referred to Antonio Conte, who's 3 managers ago now for Chelsea. I read in the Times newspaper this morning, Henry Winter wrote, "Only the naive or those too arrogant to listen to Chelsea fans refuse to acknowledge Lampard's influence." Tuchel graciously praised Lampard's role in this glory. And I did indeed hear Thomas Tuchel say that he wanted to end what Frank Lampard started, as he put it. Now, are you telling me that this team maybe a better way to ask this is, what do you think Henry Winter is talking about? What is Lampard's role in this glory?
My immediate thought when all that stuff came up after the game was, in Lampard's last match, one of his last matches, but the one that probably really sealed it, when they got battered by City at Stamford Bridge.
It was 3-0 after like 20 minutes.
Yeah, and Kante looked completely out of sorts. Now, a few months on, and also Lampard never even knew how to use Kante. I think it was as if he kind of saw him as just, he didn't know what sort of player he was. Now, of course, Kante is being seen rightfully as probably the favourite for the Ballon d'Or. And if the Ballon d'Or, I suppose, is influencing the biggest occasions to win.
I kind of feel as though Robert Lewandowski's owed a Ballon d'Or, but you know, which isn't just because they screwed him last year and he has like broken the record again. But you know, again, that's not any reflection on Kante.
Yeah, I mean, if France win the Euros, I think it's very hard to look at Kante.
Yeah, okay.
Man of the match in both semi finals and the final, though. I mean, that's kind of Leo Messi influence, really.
That's pretty good.
but I think that's just the most basic example of a profound difference between the two teams, and just how, I mean, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say the wreckage that Lampard left behind. It was a brilliant brilliant squad that was free falling, that had no kind of the players felt they had no tactical shape or instruction. They didn't really like the way, a lot of them didn't like the way Lampard spoke to them. In the aftermath of this game, Kante referred to the other manager. No, that could be just the way kind of Kante expresses himself in English. The other manager. Yeah, but I mean, other than basically, and this whole thing about this whole debate about, oh, he gave players a chance where the others wouldn't have given them a chance. Well, that's not really true, because he was appointed for the job as almost a little bit of a kind of a PR move in a year where they couldn't sign anyone. So it almost suited the club to have this, you know, this hero come back. And he had no choice but to play the kids. So it's not like he went in there and made the brave decision, got rid of a lot of stars, say, like Fergie in 95 or anything like that. It was that he couldn't sign anyone. They had to promote. They did have a good crop coming through. And the time was right to get to their chance. And then, of course, what happens as soon as they have a summer of signings, he doesn't really know what to do with them, and they don't really know what to do under him as the team free falls.
Well, I think the double thing here is remarkable. I mean, nobody gives ABB credit for 2012.
Yeah.
Literally nobody. I mean, I think I really should have gone back and looked at this, but I suspect even in 1982. When there is a case that Tony Barton just came in and sort of blew some life into embers that were already sort of, he hadn't sort of created the heat, he just sort of rekindled them. But nobody gives Ron Saunders credit for that. So why suddenly, just because a man scored loads of goals for England, is he being, you know, is there supposed to be an asterisk in the record book saying, by the way, don't forget Frank Lampard's role in this?
Yeah. The other one that I always kind of... Do you know exactly what the story was, Miguel, with Rudiger? Because he was obviously a guy who Lampard had kind of just excluded. And there he was in this game, I think, being very important. I mean, Kante, I guess, was probably the top Chelsea player, but like Rudiger made some important interventions. I mean, he was, in the sense, the Sergio Ramos of the Chelsea team. You know, he provided a little bit of the steel, let's say, that helped to seal the deal in the game. What exactly was it? Was Frank Lampard's problem with that guy?
I think this is actually another pretty key example of how different Tuchel is, how Tuchel's just a much more advanced manager, in that there was always a bit of a personality clash with Lampard. I think it basically came down to that. Whereas with Tuchel, he saw the sort of figure that Rudiger was and thought, yes, this is a different, this is something we actually need for the chemistry of a team. Because Tuchel's really interested and reads up a lot on kind of all these kind of psychology books about kind of chemistry and how group dynamics work. And he thought Rudiger was perfect for this sort of team, that he does offer something different. Whereas with Lampard, it's almost like he took the fairly old-fashioned decision that, well, we rubbish it up the wrong way a bit, don't like the way he goes about things, and Rudiger was completely ostracized. And again, that's another one to go with Kante, basically. One of the best defenders in the Champions League this season, and I think that really came across in the match, was at one point Lampard wanted to get rid of him. And again, to go back to Kante again, as recently as January, there was actually uncertainty about Kante's future, which is incredible now. But the one thing about Rudiger, separate from Lampard, and I think you're right, he was almost a Ramos figure, but also you could see it from very early on in the game. Chelsea had that kind of real commitment and ferocity about every challenge they did, you know, that kind of really defiant stuff that only really comes out in kind of games like this, but also when you have such a huge clarity of purpose, which was, again, a contrast with Lampard, but also a contrast with Manchester City on the night, who just looked confused.
Okay, well, you mentioned Manchester City. Let's talk about them. Because I did expect them to win this game. Not just because they're the better team than Chelsea. I mean, as the league table tells us, you know, they are a better team. They have been a better team. Maybe they're not going to be for too much longer, but they have been a better team over the course of the season. And they are a much more experienced team. They've been together for a longer time, doing this under Guardiola for many seasons, compared to this, you know, kind of just recently put together Tuchel Chelsea team. And I just thought, ultimately, that's going to count. They're not going to miss this chance in the final. I was wrong about this. They completely let the final pass them by. And it will be a mystery to some of them, I'm sure, till their dying day, how it can just have slipped through their fingers so easily. And I suppose that we have to start really with what Guardiola did. I turned on the TV coverage of this game, and literally the very first sounds I heard coming out of my TV was the voice of Gary Lineker saying, "And Pep Guardiola has surprised everyone with this selection." And I thought, oh my God, what is it now? I looked at it, and I have to admit, Jonathan, when I looked at the team, I thought, there's not actually that much wrong with this. You know, it was before I'd heard, for instance, the statistic that they've only played one game this season where they haven't had Fernandinho or Rodri in the team. I sort of looked at it and I thought, yeah, you know, it's a bit... I just see a lot of good players. Like, I don't necessarily... I'm not looking at this and thinking, whoa, this, you know, this definitely looks silly. The way that, for example, when they played Lyon last season, you're just like, what is this? What is this? You know, I couldn't make any sense of that. Whereas this team, it was like, okay, you know, I don't necessarily think this is a disaster, and okay, it has turned out to be. What was your initial impression of it?
Well, I'd been out all day, got in about 5 to 7, turned my laptop on, and the first thing I saw was that team sheet, and then I saw the reaction on our WhatsApp group where everyone's going, he's done it again. And yeah, my first reaction was, what on earth is Sterling doing in that team?
Yeah, well, because that was a bit of a surprise. Yeah.
When you first see it, that was a name that leapt out, because for 2 months he hasn't really played particularly well, to the point where I now think Sancho should play ahead of him for England. And then I was like, well, okay. And then the graphic on BT had Sterling on the left and De Bruyne as the false nine, which turned out to be how they did play. But my assumption was, oh no, surely Sterling will play through the middle, and then you'll have De Bruyne back in midfield and Foden will carry on playing on the left. But there's still the issue that there was just nobody at the back of the midfield. So there was two problems. One was just for lack of a holding midfielder. So that balance of getting the five men behind the ball, which is where I think Fernandinho has been so brilliant this season, at always being in the right position, at finding space to give an option for pass when they need to recycle, but also closing down passing lanes, picking up runners. And you know, he's 36 now, he can't do it every week. But Rodri, I think, I'd been very sceptical of Rodri when he first came in, but I think he's improved a lot. I don't think he's quite at Fernandinho's level, but you know, he's getting there. So to have neither of them seemed baffling. But then I think City's front five, the notional first choice front five, I think has worked incredibly well. And the only issue for me was whether it was De Bruyne or Bernardo Silva who played as a false nine, which one played a bit deeper. And so to break that up seemed totally bizarre, particularly given the one sort of orthodox attacking player or sort of bona fide attacking player in that five is Mahrez, who plays wide on the right.
Well, no.
I'm saying in the notional
in the
first
normal
choice.
One. Okay,
fair. And Mahrez is perfect playing against Chelsea because he's sitting behind Chilwell, so it stops Chilwell getting forward. And three times in that first half, Chilwell got free down the left. Now, if that front five, and I know Mahrez was there, but if that front five hadn't been broken up, maybe Chilwell wouldn't have had such license to get forward. So I think there was two. I mean, you're right, it wasn't as sort of totally off the wall as the selection against Lyon, but it was still odd enough that everybody I knew was reacting the same way. I can't believe he's got...
Why do you think he does it then? I mean, what do you think is underlying
this? I know a lot of people say it's some kind of arrogance that he wants to win it in a way that proves his own genius. I don't buy that for a second. I think it's fear. I think it's anxiety. I think deep traumas were left by the defeat to Inter in 2010 and perhaps even more so by the defeat to Chelsea in 2012. These games were... I think the Chelsea one is worse because they were totally dominant in both legs and somehow just get picked off on the break in a million to one shot. It just shouldn't have happened. But that's left that doubt there of kind of, what do I do to stop this happening again? And then it's this sort of, he's like Oedipus leaving Corinth to avoid his fate. That every step he takes to avoid his fate actually brings it closer. And it was the same against Lyon. How do I stop Lyon countering against me? I'll go to a back three, I'll mirror them. We conceded two goals on the break. And here, I presume the intention, I'm not entirely clear, but I presume the intention was to think, well, Chelsea will play with a back three. They'll sit very deep. We're going to have a lot of the ball. Therefore, we'll play an extra, a more creative midfielder to try and create more passing angles, to try and create more runners through. But that just, it disrupted their attacking rhythms to the point where their XG, I think, was 0.45. So all that nonsense you saw from, Guardiola apologists saying, if that Mahrez shot in the last minute had gone in. Well, if that Mahrez shot in the last minute had gone in, they'd have got away with it.
Mm.
And we can still read what the XG is. We can still know the evidence of our eyes watching the game. And also, it meant their defensive structure wasn't as good. And the fact that the goal comes precisely from a pass through that area where Fernandinho or Rodri would have been, and Gundogan's caught miles upfield, he's just jogging back over the halfway line as Mount plays that pass. That sort of is a big luminous arrow pointing to the error.
I'm just looking at the FBref.com record of City season, and their XG on this is the lowest in that game, with one exception, West Ham. Apparently they had a lower XG. They beat West Ham 2-1 with goals by Ruben Dias and John Stones. I remember that game. It wasn't that long ago. But then it's the Champions League final, and that's really not where you want to save up. That you don't want to produce that performance in the biggest game in the history of the club.
Miguel, so what you're saying is Tuchel is the best manager in the league apart from David Moyes.
Well, what I'm saying is I don't understand. I mean, notwithstanding all the stuff you've been saying there, Jonathan, about the trauma and, what he's been dealing with, and this is maybe his attempts to work it out, he could do finger paintings and, you'd be like, you could try to discern the demons or whatever. We're trying to figure out what's going on here. But, what I don't understand is how a brilliant, clearly experienced, clearly intelligent coach can... How does he think that it's a good idea to give his team a problem to solve they haven't encountered before? His own team in a final. Why give them a problem? Why give them something to figure out in a final? Why not just? I mean, this is what people say: keep it simple. And I mean, Guardiola hasn't got where he is in life by keeping it simple. But at the same time, is this really the time to try something that you haven't done before? It's just kind of, how can he not see that this is just, aside from exposing him to ridicule, it's just probably not going to work.
But there's a few things there that kind of they all layer onto each other, and which may actually make this problem worse going into the future as he suffers another of these defeats. I mean, first of all, as we can see from the line, but hasn't actually been as apparent this season. I mean, there's a lot of manic intensity there. He's quite a neurotic man, with that, of course, built on not. I think myself and Jonathan have talked about this on the show before, not just about his previous failures in the Champions League, but also going right back to his childhood where he was, you know, a Barcelona fan when they just couldn't win the trophy, and it was obviously always associated with Real Madrid, and then of course there's that famous example where the first time he comes to any sort of prominence was, or that famous photo of him as a ball boy in the Gothenburg game in 1986 when Barca came back from 3-0 down to get to the final. Well, what happens in that final? It's in Seville, they dominate the match and then lose on penalties in a shambles of a penalty shootout. You know, just kind of perpetuating this negative association they have with the competition. And then, I mean, that's obviously going far back, but then most immediately, he's played Chelsea twice this season, and even though the starting lineups haven't exactly been their best, he's kind of had a number done on them twice.
He played them three times, right, Chelsea?
Tuchel's Chelsea, lost in both games. And someone put it to me on Sunday morning, and obviously on Sunday morning, like, there's already a bit of stuff going around about what happened in the game and all that, and I actually do think it'd be interesting. The big piece to do after this is really what exactly happened in the City dressing room and how they responded to his instructions, what they felt they had to do. But there was two things that were said to me. One was actually someone close to the dressing room said pretty similar to what Jonathan said there. In fact, I think I passed on this message. It was basically, and I quote, I think he thought Chelsea would sit in and he would have a lot of the ball, hence his best ball players. But Chelsea are more than that and deserved victory. He underestimated them. That's one possibility maybe from those league games. But also I do wonder how big that Aguero-Panenka miss was. I mean, if Aguero scores that and Chelsea go on to win that game fairly comfortably, or sorry, City go on to win that game fairly comfortably 2-0, do those Chelsea results maybe scramble Guardiola's brain?
I just thought there's no way Aguero's going to play that game. Even if Chelsea had won that game, Guardiola would have just said, well, that game has no relation to the final, because, you know, the team that he played didn't really have any relation to the final team. And I can't remember, to be honest, Chelsea's team, but I'm sure that he would have thought, well, look, they're not going to really show me their hand in a league match. I can't be led down the garden path because we won some Premier League game because Sergio Aguero was able to kick a penalty into the net.
Maybe, yeah. But then the flip side is, of course, that he does dwell on it. He goes into the minute details. Weirdly, City actually started the game quite well, I thought, because it was if almost kind of pushed along by the occasion. And because evidently so much of this approach was going to be based on playing at speed, it was if just right at the start, they were executing things at a speed from that adrenaline that did give Chelsea a few initial problems. But within 5 minutes, I know it was Sterling bollocking Zinchenko. And obviously Zinchenko was out of position. But Zinchenko was one of about, I think, at least four City players has gone through yesterday, along with Bernardo, Foden, even De Bruyne, given he spent most of his game with his back to goal when he was on the pitch. But that had kind of, they didn't just have their own usual role to do. They had about two or three roles that they had to kind of memorise, evidently. So Zinchenko almost had to play that kind of Philippe Lam role, where he wasn't just a fullback, he had to drop into defensive midfield. And evidently, when you've never played this system before and you're doing it in the biggest game, that didn't really work out too well. And then, like, so at half-time, there was another moment when John Stones and Riyad Mahrez were going at each other. There was one point in the game, Rory pointed this out to me, where Guardiola was giving Walker instructions, and Walker just looked baffled. but this was the case. And, of course, it gets into a situation then for the goal where... Now, one thing about the season, actually, and this is relevant to the lack of a holding midfielder, where Ruben Diaz, there had been a few, he'd obviously been brilliant, but there had been a few moments where it had been suggested he might be a little bit susceptible to pace, like when Salah got in behind him in the Liverpool game that they did win 4-1. But also, of course, he was always, you know, say in a similar way to John Terry, just as an example, at Chelsea around kind of 2005, he was always protected by that holding midfielder in front of him. That protection was gone here. And what happens? Werner makes one run. Diaz is dragged out of position. Mount is able to pick a brilliant true ball through the centre. There's yet another gap that is appearing in the team throughout the game. And Havertz has his chance.
Sorry, just on that,
I think that's where you have to give Tuchel credit as well, because I'd assumed Havertz would be the false nine, and it wasn't. It was Werner, and that allowed Werner to make those runs to drag Diaz out of position.
But the question, I mean, we were talking about Guardiola's state of mind, or you know, the effect on him of all of these things. What about the effect on the players of him doing this repeatedly? Like, Fernandinho will never forgive Pep Guardiola for leaving him out on Saturday night. You know, how could you do that to me? You know, it's not even like you preferred sort of Rodri. Even that might be more logical, but just like, how could you just drop like 350 games for the club? We're playing a Champions League final. It might be my last game. What? Like, how could you do that? Now, maybe Pep thinks, I don't need to worry too much about that. Fernandinho's out of contract. Maybe he's not going to sign a new one. Maybe he's on his way. He doesn't need to really deal with the consequences of that, but there must be consequences on other players, City players must be like, oh, you know, we should have won the game and it's been taken away from us by nonsense decisions. Like, I do wonder how corrosive that is on, you know, forget about Guardiola's own self-image or self-doubt, what about his standing in his own dressing room with his players?
No, I think that's very true, because particularly when somebody who is as intense and as demanding as he is, that I was reading about the Sacchi's Milan of the late, was well, beginning of the 90s when it begins to go wrong, and the emblematic sort of conflagration is when training's just finished and Sacchi goes to Van Basten, who didn't really, he wasn't a sort of Sacchi disciple in the way that certain other players were, and Van Basten's having his lunch in the canteen and Sacchi's over to him sort of nagging away. And Van Basten just looks at him going, I'm having my fucking lunch. And it's sort of this moment in which he sort of, you know, the belief has sort of ebbed away, that kind of you can put up with this level of intensity and this level of nagging when it's working. But when it starts, not meaning not to work, but perhaps to be actively counterproductive, why on earth would you put up with that stress? And so he's obviously got credit in the bank. I mean, you know, he clearly is a brilliant coach. He's won, 9 league titles over his career. He's redefined what is possible in football. But on a day-to-day level, if you're having to deal with that all the time, you have to have buy-in. And if you don't, then you know, I think the potential for things to go badly wrong quickly is there. And you know, as Miguel says, I'd love to know what the players think when they... I mean, I don't know what the process is of them finding out what the team's going to be. But that moment when the team sheet is revealed, do the players all go, he's done it again. I can't believe he's done it again.
From the little I've heard so far, there was surprise. But just what, in terms of the Sacchi thing you said, that's interesting as well, because let's not forget, as recently as October going into November, there were so many murmurs around the City dressing room that the players were kind of done with his intensity. They were just irritated by it. They found it difficult to kind of to put up with too much. And there was a bit of surprise when he signed that contract extension. Then, of course, as happens in dressing room, he kind of recalibrated the team. He apparently became a little bit calmer himself, particularly with Juanma and Leo beside him. And once a team starts getting results again, everything calms down. But that's the issue here, that suddenly... I mean, in the build-up to this game, I did a piece on Guardiola's last Champions League win in 2011. And what was interesting, kind of from talking to people around that game and from kind of doing a lot of research around it, is the story of the game almost wasn't Barcelona and Guardiola, because what they did by that point was self-evident. They just took it to a great level. What was more interesting was the other side, which was United and Ferguson, and how they tried to solve the issue of how you play Guardiola. And it's interesting, when you read repeated things, like from Rooney to Carrick to Ferdinand, Carrick less so than the other two, but Ferdinand and Rooney are surprisingly scathing about how wrong they thought Ferguson was. Ferdinand even talks about how the one way Fergie kind of brought that back was a year later, I think it might have been a little Lillard, because I think it was before the Real Madrid Champions League game in 2012-13, where Ferguson takes the team together and admits, I got it wrong against Barca twice. And he thought this was a big moment of character from Ferguson. But, I mean, even though neither of them expressly stated here, they do talk about, like, you can see the kind of suddenly, they're second-guessing one of these greats in Europe. And there are probably parallels between Ferguson and Guardiola there and how they kind of, overthink's been the word used a lot, but they try and do something different in European games to try and prompt something, almost because they feel they need to. And it is possible both will end up with a European Cup record that is almost underperformance given their status as managers. I mean, when Guardiola won that one in 2011, you would have thought that he'd go on and actually smash the record and win 4, 5, 6 maybe. So it is amazing that a decade on, he still hasn't added to it.
Yeah, I'm just... Sorry, go on.
No, but just a final point in that. In 2011 and 2009, actually, what's really interesting about what Ferdinand is talking about as well, it's all in his autobiography, is how no matter what they did in the league, it was completely coloured by the defeat in the Champions League final. That's how huge it was in the players' consciousness. And he said the players were just depressed after that, even though they got title number 18 in 2009 and title number 19 to go ahead of Liverpool in 2011. And yet that didn't matter for the squad at all, because they'd been well beaten in the Champions League final by Barca twice.
Yeah, I mean, I completely accept the parallel and they clearly are interesting points of reference there. But the difference, the huge difference is Ferguson was trying to take on this immense power, playing a new sort of football, the like of which we'd never seen before. Yeah. Nobody knew what the formula was. Nobody knew what the answer was. And so experimenting with something, taking a risk, made some kind of sense. Here, Guardiola's playing at a team that finished 19 points behind him in the league. Now, okay, Tuchel appears to have some kind of hold over him now, that Tuchel has become only the sixth manager to win 3 games against Guardiola, which is a ridiculous statistic. And he's only the second to win 3 in a row after Klopp in 2017-18. So maybe Tuchel sort of looms as this monster, but he's not the sort of devastating force, this sort of all-conquering power that Barcelona were in 2011. So I think it's far less forgivable to tinker in that way.
But that's what I mean. Like, I mean, I just draw on the United. I mean, that's a manager like Ferguson, who obviously had such a hold and such an authority. Whereas the context of this, it is that bit more fragile given how they went into the season, and also given how dominant they were, that they've kind of blown this chance. So you do, I mean, just to, I suppose, in relation to how the squad might see him, it is a potential issue now going forward. Even though the general, I mean, City, they're the wealthiest club in the world. They'll probably be back here soon, maybe next season. But does this create issues with Guardiola? It's suddenly one of these, storylines this final has thrown up.
Yeah, and I do agree with your point that it's a sort of depressing end to the season for City. You know, it's been a really successful league campaign. They've played brilliantly at times. They've set various records, and the season's just ended really terribly, and they'll feel bad about it. And one of the ways, I suppose, that you can change that feeling is by making exciting signings. City have got some space on the payroll. Aguero's left. Fernandinho probably. They've got money to spend. They've been linked with a series of players. These are four of the names. These are four superstar names that City are linked with. Haaland, Lukaku, Grealish, Kane, right? Of those four players, Harry Kane is the only one that I can see going into Pep Guardiola dressing room and there not being some kind of an incident. I just have a feeling, and this is speculative for different reasons maybe in each case, but I just have a feeling that Haaland, Lukaku and Grealish, none of them have like Pep Guardiola Blair written all over them as far as I can see. I think Harry Kane is a sort of a, look, I've won nothing, who am I? I'm humble enough to learn from Pep, Pep, teach me what you know about being a false nine. The other three, I can kind of see them all being rubbed up the wrong way by Guardiola. I don't know what your impressions are on that.
Yeah, I do know that on one of his rounds of golf, which is usually apparently where Pep Guardiola switches off his phone, it's the only time he allows himself to kind of immerse himself in something else that he doesn't think about football. But I heard he was on a golf course with someone that worked with Grealish, and was absolutely peppering him with questions about what Grealish is like as a person, because he knows how good he is as a footballer. So that relates to your point. But from the way people talk about that, that deal is apparently done. Right, and I think that can also be seen in the news story that came out this week, where City are looking for buyers for Sterling and Mahrez, and that's basically great space for Grealish, because, I mean, they're who he's going to succeed.
What, he's going to replace both Sterling and Mahrez? it seems like a lot to ask.
No, it's basically just, I mean, they're looking for buyers for, and it's who they can sell first, I suppose.
If they can sell either, okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And apparently there's a few players have been looking to, not necessarily looking to move on, but basically they want to just create that bit of space in the squad. I think the striker one's more interesting, because suddenly we also get into questions about, you know, who will suit Guardiola's play. This was also an issue that actually happened to Guardiola, Barcelona as well, where the style of football became so defined that, I mean, it was one of the strange things at that Barca. Their transfer record was so hit and miss, because it was so difficult for players to drop in, no matter how good they were. Mm. You know, Sanchez, one of them, even Cesc Fabregas, who was, you know, a Barca product and all the rest of it, he struggled in adapting in that team and kind of changed the chemistry of it. And like, so at Haaland, there's already been some talk that even though he scores loads of the exact sort of kind of back post tap-ins, he's got a huge proportion of them that that usually looks perfect for Guardiola's side. Apparently Guardiola himself has a few reservations about how he might fit in, whereas the club obviously see Haaland, that they signed, like, he's one player worth 150 million or whatever it's going to be, because he's so young. So you're not just investing in for goals next season, next two seasons. This is basically the next 8 years. Mm-hmm. Then with Kane,
does Guardiola really want to sign literally a man who bases his personality on Zlatan Ibrahimovic?
Well, yeah, that's another issue as well. Especially given his relationship with his agent, Mino Raiola, where, I mean, previously there's been
who was also Zlatan's agent. I mean,
yes, exactly. But on that, I'd been told a few months ago as well that apparently Raiola and City's director of football, Chiqui Begiristain, they'd kind of come to an entente and solved their own issues.
I've never heard Mino Raiola call Chiqui Begiristain a dog in public. Fair enough.
That's true. Although, but then the other side of this, the other thing you hear from around the Haaland side is that there are about five or six clubs in Europe, including Chelsea, who basically think, oh yes, we're his number one choice. Haaland wants to come to us. And so City and Chelsea are the same in that sense. And I suppose that's how well Raiola's done his job. But they will sign. They'll probably get Grealish and they will sign a striker. Lukaku, actually, I'm not so sure on, because apparently I think Guardiola himself isn't much a fan of the other two, Lukaku was the other two.
Well, he basically isn't a fan of any strikers.
Well, yeah. This was the other side of this, yes. That, and also, in some ways, Saturday was Guardiola's great vision. Fill the team with 5'8" central midfielders. Yeah. But we saw the limits of that vision, especially against Kante.
What do you think, Jonathan, just finally from you on those? If you were City, okay, Grealish is there. You know, I'm not sure. Grealish has got a bit of a let Jack be Jack vibe about him, I feel, which I'm looking forward to seeing how he fits into being programmed by Guardiola. But what about those other guys?
Well, I mean, yeah, but the thing with Grealish is that he's of an age where, yeah, he probably needs to start winning. You know, this is the move where he needs to step up, and he's still young enough to learn new tricks, and he must be aware that doing his jackish things aren't necessarily going to win trophies at the biggest clubs. Well,
I mean, they would if he's got teammates, you know, the level that he's playing with at Man City, surely.
Well, no, but he'd have to adapt himself to the system, is my point. And I think,
I think Man City could still win the league with another manager who wasn't Pep Guardiola, as they've repeatedly demonstrated in the last, you know, under their previous managers. You know what I mean? Is I think Grealish doesn't necessarily need to be reprogrammed as some kind of a Guardiola winger to be successful. Maybe he does if he's playing for a Pep Guardiola team. You know, do you see what I mean? Like, I don't think he necessarily needs to learn what Pep Guardiola has to teach in order to be a top player.
Well, okay, but if he's going to City, then he does need to learn, because Guardiola will be there, at least for the start of next season, and quite probably for a long time beyond that. I also think he's got a greater chance of winning the league if he allows himself to be reprogrammed by Guardiola. In terms of the three forwards, I guess the order of preference goes Kane, Haaland, Lukaku. I sort of still feel Lukaku is a little bit... I still don't quite think we've seen what he's capable of. That there's been little glimmers of a genuinely incredible centre forward there, who has all the technical and tactical gifts as well as this incredible imposing physique. And I think that performance against Brazil in the World Cup in the quarterfinal in 2018, when he essentially played right wing with De Bruyne through the middle, I think that's one of the most outstanding individual performances I remember sort of seeing live. So I think there is capacity there, but I just sort of feel it's never been consistently unlocked. But I think the other problem City have is, what are we doing with Fernandinho? If he goes, and even if he doesn't go, he's 36, do they trust Rodri to carry that burden alone? I mean, we've now seen that you can't trust Gundogan to do it. I mean, maybe you could trust Gundogan to do it against Crystal Palace or Burnley, but I don't think you can trust Gundogan to do it against a top side.
Okay, well, a lot for them to think about. Thank you very much, as ever, for joining us and chatting about the Champions League final.
Cheers, thank you.
Cheers.
Who's better, LeVar or Michael Jordan?
Ain't nobody think about no damn LeVar.
Yes, they are.
Owen McDevitt from Ireland's Second Captain Show.
Owen McDevitt, you're a cold piece of work.
You're looking good. I know you're feeling good.
Owen, you're amazing.
I'm like, yeah.
2,000 podcast recordings today and the Second Captain Show in Ireland. Owen McDevitt.
Owen, I like you and I like your style.
Yeah. I hear you in your 40s and you're bald-headed. Let's just put it this way. You're ahead of Owen McDevitt.
Hey, Jack Charlton, we're just about out of time. Been a pleasure talking to you.
I can't believe it, dog. I know what 2,000 is. And that's a heck of a feat. But any man, I love your style.
It's delicious.
I'm Owen McDevitt.
Owen McDevitt.
He's a non-event as far as I'm concerned.
All right, June means meaningless Ireland friendlies, but the great thing about being on an 11-match winless streak is that means no games are ever meaningless. Can we break our duck on Thursday night? Stay tuned to find out. We'll be there for every agonising, soul-destroying moment. It's Andorra on Thursday night, Ken.
Well, we won't be there. I'm not going to be in Andorra.
We'll be there, as in we'll be experiencing it.
Not there, reporting on it. Yeah. Watching it and trying to...
Ah, come on. Cut me some slack here, Ken, will you?
Sorry.
It's Ireland-Andorra. And actually, it does kind of seem like a reasonably important game.
Win, lose, or draw, it's going to be historic.
Yeah. That is not gilding the lily. I do believe historic is the word. That's pretty much it. Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you very much, Kieran. And thank you very much, Chelsea Football Club.
Yeah, you've entertained the world. Thanks a million for listening. We'll chat to you on the World Service tomorrow.
Did he bring the players in? Did he bring the Germans in?
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.